Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
This is episode 382. Welcome back to the program. Big thank you to Gillingham Lodge for having me out there. We Skyped in over to the UK. It was a great experience. I got to virtually experience some great fellowship. I'm also going to be doing something very similar for Kadisha Lodge in Lebanon. I couldn't travel over there, so we're Skyping in. And that'll be coming up later this week, actually. Pretty excited about that. And the next presentation after that is going to be March 19th. I'll be at Gateway number 40 in St. Louis, Missouri. Topic is to be determined. I think that's still going to happen, as far as I know. But anyway, I've got several short articles for you this week, and I'd like to just jump right in. So let's get started right after this. The Whence Came You podcast is brought to you through the generous support of Masonic Revival, contemporary Masonic designs made for today's Freemason. You don't have to settle for throwing a plain old square and compass on anything anymore. Now you get something truly designed and truly wonderful. Whether it's aprons, awesome pins, and wonderful neckwear, bow ties, ties, pocket squares, you name it, Masonic Revival has it. Head on over to MasonicRevival.com and check out what they have to offer. If you use promo code WCY at checkout, that means free shipping also. And make sure if you see Brother Edgar, tell him thanks for helping bring this program to all of you. And this program is also brought to you by all of you, those of you who support this program. We can't do it without you and your donations and all of your assistance, so thank you so much. To find out more about how you can assist this program, head on over to WCYpodcast.com and click on Support the Show. There you can make direct donations, sign up to be a monthly contributor, a fellow, or even a producer. And thanks very much to everybody for donating. Now, the first piece I have is a topic near and dear to me, and sometimes this topic comes up and it's explored in different ways. Now, the topic of the paper is called The Mystery of the Lost Word. There are many philosophies regarding the lost word and what it represents. If you are a fan of mine and you've listened to my lecture on this, then you know that I've proposed that the lost word is a real thing. But let's see where Brother Alexander Horn goes. The mystery of the lost word. Benjamin Franklin once said that the only secret Freemasonry had was that it had no secret. Mackey, however, with a greater insight, pointed out that there was indeed a secret, but that the secret was only symbolically represented by the lost word. Actually, it lies in another dimension entirely, for the secret itself is divine truth, with all its implications, and the search for the quote-unquote lost word, in the last analysis, is but a search after absolute truth. That is the view of our best thinkers. In the words of one of the most profound among them, Arthur Edward Waite, the secret word is secret only by reason of its having secret meaning. It is veiled in allegory and illustrated by symbols. And it is the allegory and the symbol that we have to unravel in the future ages that are before us. Only then will we have recovered the lost word. Thus it is profoundly true that the real secret of Freemasonry is not where we commonly hope to find it, and for many of us, what we do find in our hands for a long time is but a substitute, for it is not a word we are after, or even its meaning, but an idea. The true word of the Master Mason would be a paltry thing if indeed it could be wrapped up like a dose of headache powders in a neat little package for everyone to possess. Instead, we find that, like the ever-receding horizon, the mystery of the lost word is something we forever attempt to approach, if we search for it at all, but never appear to reach. Or perhaps it is more like a parabolic curve of the mathematicians forever approaching its asymptote, and forever decreasing the gap between them, but finally closing it forever, theoretically at least, only in the infinitudes. The idea behind the symbol of the lost word is thus an idea that encompasses all the inscrutable mysteries of existence, life and God, and the profundities of nature, and the depths of the human soul, and the utmost recesses of the human heart and mind, and the divine truth for which we seek has all the impalpable implication of the misty rainbow, at the end of which, but only at the end, is the pot of gold. So Alexander Horn here is interesting in that I fully agree with everything he says, but this is typical of people who are looking for the lost word. I do believe that there is a literal lost word that was used in Freemasonry, and that this is separate from the lost word philosophy of the core singular dogmatic teaching that Freemasonry has. I do believe Freemasonry has a singular purpose. Because it's a lost word, or the concept is lost until it's discovered, it's something that I can't talk about. However, pieces like this seem to reaffirm the idea that there is something deeper. There are other authors out there that do this as well. They almost write an apologia for those who are of the philosophical and continually search for this lost word or the lost philosophy. I always call it, whenever I'm referring to it, as the revelation. There are so many authors out there today that write about the great secret of the mysteries, and they dance around the topic and manage, amazingly, in 300 pages, to never give the reader a clue. It's all about, oh, if you only knew, the true reader, the true philosopher will, blah, blah, blah. And it's unfortunate. This has a couple purposes, the first of which is probably to satisfy a need to shout from the mountaintops that there is a secret. And it also allows the readers to be inspired to continue the search if they haven't. And then there are those who, like Alexander Horn here, or men like J.D. Buck and some of the things he's quoted as saying, that affirm the philosophy and say, yes, it is real. And all these people are literally dancing around it all the time, and it's a shame, and it exists. But what these guys still don't tell you is what I'm going to tell you right now, and that is the fundamental nature of the revelation is such that the knower cannot express it. It is a singular idea that I could just say right now, but what value would that have to somebody who hasn't reached that in their own life? So the mystery of the lost word. I really liked this short paper, and I hope it inspires you to continue your search for divine truth. Next up, I have a piece called Allegories, Symbols, and Emblems by Ralph S. Davis. Freemasonry has been defined as a system of morality veiled in allegory and illustrated by symbols. A study of the words in this definition is illuminating. An allegory is a kind of narrative in which the story directly presented is intended to convey by implication another story with a definite meaning or lesson. The word is derived from the Greek allegoria, meaning description of one thing under the image of another. Allegories may be based on actual happenings or may be the form of parables. An allegory is frequently used to teach an ethical or spiritual lesson by analogy or comparison. Brother Douglas Knoop, a past master of Kotor Koronati Lodge of Research and the eminent Masonic scholar and writer, says, quote, "In a century in which allegorical interpretations of the scriptures was commonly practiced, as is shown, for example, by the publication in 1688 of John Bunyan's Solomon's Temple Spiritualized, it would not be surprising to find that the use of allegory was introduced into Freemasonry at that period," end quote. The legends of Freemasonry, of which there are many, are in some measure allegorical in character. Whether they are based on historical facts is immaterial, as it is only as allegories or legendary symbols that they are of importance to Masons. While there may be no substantial difference in the intent of an allegory and a symbol, there is a distinct difference in character. An allegory may be interpreted without any previous conventional agreement, but this is not so with a symbol. The allegory, for example, of the Master Mason degree is interpreted as teaching a restoration to life, and this we learn from the legend itself without previous understanding. The beehive is a symbol of industry, and this we know because its meaning had been determined when the symbol was established in the first place. Allegories, symbols, and emblems are closely related as used in Freemasonry. All the instructions in the mysteries of Freemasonry are communicated in the form of symbols. a symbol suggesting something else by reason of relationship, a representation by an image, whether that image is a visible or tangible substance or only brought before the mind by words, as in the allegory. An emblem is a visible sign of an idea, an object or the figure of an object, symbolizing and suggesting another object or idea. The symbol is more extensive in its application. All emblems are symbols, but all symbols are not emblems. In Freemasonry, however, the two words are often used synonymously in expressing an idea when making a comparison of some visible object with a moral concept or attribute. Freemasonry, as a speculative science derived from the operative art, has taken the working tools of the profession which it spiritualizes and adopted them as symbols, thus teaching its great moral and philosophical lessons by this method of symbolism. Why does Masonry teach by symbol? At a time when letters were unknown, the record of passing events was carved on stone or inscribed on other materials in the form of pictorial representations. As time passed, the intellectual powers of man developed and letters came into use, yet notwithstanding, men still used pictures and symbols as they made a deeper and more lasting impression on the mind. Masonry retains this most ancient method of instruction, as this method is more appealing to the physical sight. Masonry uses it to inculcate upon the mind its great moral lessons. Thus, for example, the square, level, and plumb are no longer merely the working tools of an operative mason's art, for the beautiful symbolism of Masonry has clothed them with more noble and glorious meanings. They then become visible, tangible, emblems of important truths and duties. Therefore, Masonry teaches by symbol, and symbolism is the very lifeblood of and essence of Masonry. It is well to remember that a symbol has no virtue in itself. It is truth concealed in the symbol for which you must seek and find to qualify yourself to receive the wages which you are due. And that's the end of that piece. I think this piece is interesting because if we think about it, and we connect it to the idea of the previous research paper, we can make some interesting correlations there. Now comes the point in the show where I ask you to help support this show. How do we do that? Well, we have a bunch of different ways to do that today. If you head on over to WCYpodcast.com, you can click on direct donation through PayPal, which we briefly touched on in the beginning of the program. Of course, you can make that one-time donation, or you can sign up to be a monthly contributor. Contributing $2 a month, $5, or even $10 a month, whatever you choose really helps the program out. Of course, we have a limited edition shop where you can pick up any number of items that come direct from us. Help us out by going to MasonicRevival.com, but also we have some other affiliates that are really important. Bankers Best, one of the most unique things we've ever done, is to work with Brother Levi Banker out of St. Louis, who owns his own company called Bankers Best Beard and Skincare. He's been so generous. If you head to WCYpodcast.com, click on More, then click on Banker's Best, and you can check out a bunch of the different products he's got. He's got a whole line of beard care products, skin care, oils, balms, all of this stuff, and he has been doing it a long time. He knows a lot about it. Everything is handmade, quality items. We even came up with the King Solomon's Reserve Beard Balm, which is a few years old now, but remains one of the great products that he still offers. Even the artwork on the bottle was done by a brother. The nice thing about this particular product is 50% of the proceeds come back to the program. If you're a history guy like me, then you'll be pleased to know that what makes the beard oil and balm very special is that it was made utilizing the fragrances specific to the exports of King Solomon's time and location, which is amazing. So black fig and honey is the formula. Luxurious scent, as Levi says, truly fit for our first Grand Master. If you use the promo code BBWCY357 at checkout, you'll also get a little bit of a percentage off. Please check that out. Bankers Best, or just head on over to buybankersbest.com. We also have a code with Onnit. You can go to our website, click on More, then go to Onnit, and you can click through any of the links here, or just go to Onnit.com and use the promo code WCY at checkout. You'll get 10% off, and they'll send a little bit back to the program to help us out. And of course, it's business time. The book that I wrote with John T. Ruark, it is making some real waves, and people are using it and Seeing Success. So check that out on Amazon. You can click right to it. You can get it on Audible, Kindle, or in print, even on iBooks. And last but not least, I want to ask you to check out the Great Books program. You'll see the banner for it on the left-hand side, Intellectual Linear Progression. Use the promo code WCY, or you can just click on that link there, and you'll actually go right to the website and hear a little bit from Scott Hambrick about how awesome the program is. So that's it. I hope you guys enjoy, and thank you so much for helping us out. The next piece I have for you this week is reprinted from the Cryptic Freemasonry, Volume Number 12, 1, Winter 1990-1991, entitled The Secret Vault. Dr. Oliver gives an account of the legend of the Secret Vault as discovered in the construction of the Second Temple as follows. The foundation of the temple were opened and cleared from the accumulation of the rubbish, that a level might be procured for the commencement of the building. When engaged in excavations for this purpose, three fortunate sojourners are said to have discovered our ancient stone foundation, which had been deposited in the secret crypt by wisdom, strength, and beauty to prevent the communication of ineffable secrets to profane or unworthy persons. The discovery having been communicated to the prince, prophet, and priest of the Jews, the stone was adopted as the chief cornerstone of the re-edified building and thus became, in a new and more expressive sense, the type of a more excellent dispensation. An avenue was also accidentally discovered, supported by seven pairs of pillars, perfect and entire, which, from their situation, had escaped the fury of the flames that had consumed the temple, and the desolation of war that had destroyed the city. The secret vault, which had been built by Solomon as a secure depository for certain secrets that would have inevitably been lost without some such expedient for their preservation, communicated by a subterranean avenue with the king's palace. But, at the destruction of Jerusalem, the entrance having been closed by rubbish of falling buildings, it had been discovered by the appearance of a keystone among the foundations of the Sanctum Sanctorum. A careful inspection was then made, and the invaluable secrets were placed in a safe custody. But of this legend there are various understandings, and as Brother Mackey says, to support this legend, there is no historic evidence and no authority except that of the Talmudic writers. It is clearly a mythical symbol, and as such, we must accept it. We cannot altogether reject it. It is so intimately and so extensively connected with the symbolism of the lost and recovered word that if we reject the theory of the secret vault, we must abandon all of the symbolism and with it the whole of the science of Masonic symbolism. Fortunately, there is ample evidence in the present appearance of Jerusalem and its subterranean topography to remove from any tacit and, as it were, conventional assent to the theory features of absurdity and impossibility. Considered simply as a historic question, there can be no doubt of the existence of immense vaults beneath the superstructure of the original Temple of Solomon. Prime, Robinson, and other writers who in recent times have described the topography of Jerusalem speak of the existence of three of these structures which they visited and, in some instances, carefully examined. In the early ages, the cave or vault was deemed sacred. The first worship was in caves and temples, which were either natural or formed by artisans to resemble the excavations of nature. An interesting piece for sure, just kind of explaining this idea of the lost vaults. There are many avenues the researcher can take here, looking up the Enochian vaults. You can look up several different degrees within Freemasonry, primarily the cryptic council degrees or the cryptic degrees within the York Rite system. And also, there are a few degrees at the end of the Lodge of Perfection within the Scottish Rite Southern Jurisdiction that also deals with this allegory, the subsequent loss, recovery, and loss again of the word or the philosophy, whichever you'd like to correlate this to. And the piece somewhat abruptly ends right there. So, because it was so short, we have one more. Will there be a fourth temple? Also reprinted from the Cryptic Freemason, volume number 10, number 2, spring 1989. When the Israelites came out of Egypt, they worshipped in the tabernacle, which was a tent about 45 feet long and 13.5 feet wide. The framework was of acacia wood. Inside, the covering was of a fine linen in blue, purple, and scarlet. This was covered by curtains of goat's hair. On top of this was a waterproof covering of ram skins. Over this was another waterproof covering of fine leather. After David's conquests, his son Solomon built the temple of stone and cedars. Our modern Masonic Lodge, follows this pattern of the floor plan. King Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the temple in 578 BCE. The Jewish people were captive in Babylon for many years. Finally, King Cyrus allowed those Jews that wished to return to their homeland. He ordered them to rebuild the temple. All the gold and silver and sacred objects were returned to Jerusalem. After difficulties, Zerubbabel completed the second temple in 515 BCE. It was destroyed by the Roman general Pompey in 63 BCE. The third temple was by far the grandest. It was built by Herod the Great, and the main building was finished about 9 BCE. Built on the same plan as Solomon's temple, it was twice as high and covered with so much gold that it dazzled in the sunlight. It was destroyed by the Romans at the time of the Jewish rebellion in 70 AD, and its treasures taken to Rome. In 643 CE, the Muslims began construction of the Mosque of Omar on the site of King Solomon's, Zerubbabel's, and Herod's temple, because they say it was the place which Muhammad ascended into heaven. As such, it was the most sacred of places, second only to Mecca and Medina. There has been some talk of the Jews building another temple. A fund has even been started. But how is this possible? Any attempt by the Jews to take over the Mosque of Omar probably would cause all the Muslim countries to declare war on Israel. A temple elsewhere would not be the same. Perhaps the only solution is for the world to be at peace with people respecting each other's rights, so that the Jews and the Muslims could and would share the same building on the site of King Solomon's original temple. Now note, what's interesting here is the date of this article, 1989. Shortly after this paper's publication, Monday, October 8th, 1990, is what's known as the Al-Aqsa Massacre, where a bunch of radicals actually, from what I understand, tried to storm the mosque, and 22 people were killed, and more than 200 were injured, and over 270 others were arrested, and this was due to the particular radical sect who tried to lay the foundation for an official third temple at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And so the words at the end of this piece, where they talk about living in peace with each other, are so crucial when we have tensions like this. But the way this article reads, it talks about the fourth temple, which actually would be the third temple because they're counting the first Egyptian tabernacle as the first. But in terms of on that site, it would be the third temple if anything were ever built there. But again, as Masons, we meet together, many faiths under one roof. And I think we all have that one aim in mind, which is the brotherhood of man under the fatherhood of God. That's it for this week. I hope you guys all enjoyed the program and got a little something out of it. I will have the articles all in PDF form as bonus features in the show. Go ahead and download those at your leisure. If you like Masonic articles, don't forget about the Midnight Freemasons. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, we have new articles out all the time. And the Masonic Roundtable, another great podcast to listen to. It's like The View, but with a bunch of Masons, a bunch of goofball Masons at that. But we bring the education, we bring insights from around the country, and we interact with the listeners via the YouTube channel. So you can watch live as it happens, ask questions. It's really fun. That is happening live every Thursday at 9:30, 8:30 Central. We are still on track to be putting together a couple extra little projects for you all to dive into. And with that, I'll wish you all a wonderful week. Until next time, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.